So since we are approaching Tisha B'Av, and there is a custom in the period leading up to Tisha B'Av, one studies the laws or the teachings relating to the Beit HaMikdash, to the temple, with the idea that kol halomet Torah Ola ki'ilu hikriv Ola. Anyone who studies the laws of the burnt offering in the temple, it's as if he has offered the burnt offering. And so therefore, by studying about the temple, there's a sense in which we are rebuilding the temple and experiencing the temple. So there's this juncture between study and reality, you know, and where is the true reality? Is it in what we study or is it in what we do? And if we do it without studying it, is it really done? So certainly the study has a powerful effect. So we can look at three different aspects, I think. One is the practical nature of the temple, which is expressed in these two diagrams that we have here, which, as I mentioned, come from the Tiferet Yisrael commentary on the Mishnah, published at the end of the 19th century. And we'll look at the practical characteristics of the temple. Then we have some pages from the Tanya, towards the end of the first section of Tanya, which talks about the nature of the temple in a Kabbalistic way. And then we will maybe consider one or two points from this article, Sacred Garden, Sacred World, which also is a Kabbalistic way of looking at the temple. So first of all, let's see the diagram. So we'll look at the first diagram. Can anyone tell me where the Kotel HaMaravi is? You need to look at this diagram. Nachon, 10 out of 10, straight away.
Maharav, it says Maharav, that's right. That's west. Very good.
Yeah. Now, you see, this is the diagram of the what's called Ha Habayit. You can see on the bottom left in this square, it says Ha Habayit, which means the Temple Mount. Now, the Temple Mount is the outer perimeter of the temple. You can't go into the Temple Mount unless one is ritually pure. We can't be ritually pure at this point in history because we haven't got the ashes of the red heifer. Because all of us, technically, are assumed to be impure from the dead. The reason for that is some people have been to a cemetery or have been, had something, went to a funeral, carried the coffin. And other people just walked around in Hampstead. And who knows what happened in Hampstead in, this street or that garden at such, at some time previously. So as far as the sages are concerned, the whole world is potentially a graveyard. In the land of Israel, they tried very hard to ascertain where there were graves and where there were not graves, because a Kohen could not walk through a field where there was assumed to be a grave.
But why? I mean, why this the whole concept of impurity of the dead?
Well,
on the other hand, you have a mitzvah to wash bodies and prepare
absolutely
them. So I don't understand.
There you have the junction of two different concepts.
Yes.
That the highest mitzvah is looking after a dead body. The Chevra Kadisha, which means the sacred fellowship, is in the traditional Jewish community, it is the most, it's at the top of the hierarchy of Jewish society. And they are a group of people, a group of men looking after male corpses and a group of women looking after female corpses. And they are regarded with the utmost respect in the traditional Jewish community. It's something In the general United Synagogue structure, it's really a kind of a paid job. But in the wider traditional community, it's something which learned, scholarly, and respected people do voluntarily as a great honor to be able to look after the dead and prepare them for burial. At the same time, doing that makes them impure. And so the being impure does not imply any moral issue. Being impure is a particular state which is acquired through certain situations. Just as menstruation, there's nothing wrong with menstruation, it's a sign of healthy womanhood. But nonetheless, that makes a woman impure until she goes to the mikveh. So impurity and impurity are not good and bad, but they do restrict one in certain ways. And one of the ways that they restrict us is that we cannot go into the temple when we are ritually impure. So it says that if the high priest is on the way to the temple to carry out the service for Yom Kippur, and he encounters a met mitzvah, a corpse which has no one to bury, he should forget about everything and just occupy himself with burying that corpse, even though that's going to render him unfit to carry out the Yom Kippur service, and so on. So, and he will be impure as well. So all this is together with the fact that death, the opposite of life, is in itself a source of impurity. Even menstruation, we can see in those terms, because it simply means that that ovum was not fertilized.
Oh yeah.
And it's now being washed out of the body. So therefore, the menstruation signifies the opposite of life.
Of life,
because
yes.
Because there wasn't conception, there wasn't birth, and there wasn't life. And so therefore, on that scale of life expressing purity and the opposite of life, death expressing impurity. And nonetheless, we have to deal with death, and death is part of our relationship with the world and with the divine. However, that means no one can go, if they're going to keep the halakha, they can't go into the Temple Mount. And so the west wall, which is along here, there's some discussion about exactly where we locate ourselves in the west wall, and where is, you see here is the Holy of Holies. If you're standing at the west wall of Jerusalem, where exactly is this? My favorite interpretation is that following some kind of teaching by Rabbi Isaac Luria, which would seem to present the more or less, I would say, the divide between the male and female part of the West Wall area is pretty well here where the Holy of Holies is. So it's over the wall, that would be the place where it's the Holy of Holies. There are other theories which try to put the Al-Aqsa Mosque as the position of the Holy of Holies, with the idea that the huge rock inside it is somehow the Eben Shtiyah, the stone. It speaks in the Mishnah about a stone which was in the Holy of Holies. But in the entire Talmudic literature, it is never referred to as a huge stone. It's referred to as a slab, 3 fingers high, so, or 3 tfachim high, but it's a low slab rather than a gigantic rock. So if this rock is actually a meteor or something like that, which some people assume
yeah,
could well have appeared in a much later period after the time of the temple. I would position, you know, we could think of the area just here as where the women stand on this side and the men are standing on that side.
Have you been to the tunnels?
Yes.
And there is a point that they think, which is the point that is Diagonally opposite. Have you been to the tunnels?
Yes, now I'm not sure on what basis they think
that. I don't know, but
there was a synagogue there, mm-hmm. I think. Yes.
Well, I don't know what basis, and I don't know what is the point, but I do remember whoever took us in.
Yeah, so that would mean that the west wall where we congregate is over here, and the tunnel takes us that way.
But it's the entrance of the tunnel is on your far left, no?
It is actually.
In the
not
very
that.
Far left.
Left,
corner.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes, so that means.
I was just confusing that how do you get to the middle? Because it runs through.
No, so you
and
see,
it twists as
this
well.
This would be the area where we stand at the west wall, and then on your far left, you go into the tunnel.
Yes, yes.
And so then, by the time you walk 100 yards or something the tunnel, then they tell you that this is where the whole. You know, so
maybe
that
I wasn't aware of where I was turning. Okay.
I think it's basically
going straight
line.
When you're
it's a
there.
Straight line.
Have you been to the tunnel?
Too long ago. This is the thing, and then. The people are outside of the temple, isn't it?
Yes, but it's already the temple precinct. They're not in the temple, but it's the temple precinct. So that's called the Temple Mount.
The Western Wall is not this, but this. The Western Wall, which we see. Which one is it? The small one or the long one?
No, the outer one.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah, we wouldn't be able to go up to it if it was the smaller wall, because that would already be in the Temple Mount area.
Right.
Which is already sacred ground.
Tell me, why is it so difficult to define the boundaries of the Holy of the Holies if the measurements have been given to us by the...
The measurements have been given, but relative to what? That's right. Mm-hmm. You see, there isn't any kind of obvious landmark where we can say exactly where it was. I mean, there are theories based on. You know.
On the way the stones fell as well, because.
That's right. You know, but it's.
Archaeologists must have some kind of a notion, an idea.
I've just been outside.
Well, I assume that that what one is told as one goes through the tunnel is on the basis of archaeologists' assumptions.
Yeah.
But it's not, you know, it's not a hundred assumption.
Yeah.
In fact, the Talmud talks about the problem of the issue. Not about where the Holy of Holies is, but where is the place of the altar?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
And the solution, the sort of rather radical solution the Talmud finds, it regards the place of the altar as fundamentally significant. In fact, if we just turn over the page, we'll be able to see it more clearly. We'll come back to that larger picture, but you see, here is the outer courtyard.
Yeah.
And then as we go towards the west, there's the inner courtyard, and then there is the altar. Now, that altar is understood to be the place from which Adam and Eve were created. That the earth, that dust, was taken from the place of the altar in Jerusalem. And there... Adam and Eve offered an offering to God, and later, I can't remember, Cain and Abel also tried to make an offering there, and certainly Noah made an offering there, and Abraham was ready to offer Isaac at Akedat Yitzhak, at the binding of Isaac, at that spot of the altar. So it's regarded as a fundamentally significant spot. The question is, where exactly is that spot? So the way the sages presented is, when the Messiah comes, there will be the revival of the dead, and Moses and Aaron will be revived. They will then be able to tell us exactly where the spot
without
is.
Without satellite navigation.
The interesting thing is...
Amazing. Beam it out to the world.
What do you say?
Without satellite navigation.
Without, yeah, well, the interesting
not
thing
only
is...
Not only that, beaming it on cameras all over the world.
Yeah, but neither Moses and Aaron actually had been there.
They were not allowed in.
Yeah. That's right.
No, only King Solomon would tell us. King Solomon would tell us.
I guess you need a few weeks.
Well, the Talmud could have said King Solomon would tell us, but in fact it says Moses and Aaron. So it just shows that physically being there and spiritually being somewhere are two different things.
By that
things.
Stage, we'll probably be fine anyway.
Yes.
Yeah. Why all those letters? What do they signify?
Okay, so let's just go back to the larger drawing. Now, first of all, on the left-hand side, you can see Hulda's Gate. There are two gates. Hulda's Gate, and if you walk round the wall of the Temple Mount today, which you can do, there are two gates which are identified as Hulda's Gates. They are closed, but they are identified as Hulda's Gates. So you can actually walk round here. It's
the wall.
You're not referring to the Shaar HaRachamim, the double blocked gates.
Shaar HaRachamim.
Where the graveyard is then?
Overlooking the Mount Ole.
Yes.
Is it on that side?
It is.
No, it's here. You.
This one here.
The Hulda Gate is here, yes?
Yeah, those are the two Hulda Gates.
Where would be Mount Olives? Here or here?
This is what's confusing.
When you say you can see them today.
You see them, you're walking alongside the wall.
That's right.
This wall.
Are they blocked?
Yes, they're blocked.
So it is what we call in Hebrew Shaar HaRachamim.
All right, I'm not sure.
I think that's what we call it.
The tradition is that the Messiah, on the day of redemption, will walk through Shaar HaRachamim, which is now blocked,
right,
and redeem the people of Israel. This is one of the traditions.
I mean,
but this is maybe the Hulda Gate.
Yeah, I mean, the way the Mishnah describes it is the Hulda Gate, and certainly in terms of walking alongside, you know, from where the Kotel area, the Kotel plaza is, one can then, you know, you somehow pay some money and you're then able, you're in this precinct where you can walk along over here. That's it. There are various interesting excavations.
Does it have to be controlled? I mean, is there any problem with that area being under authority of Jewish people or anybody?
Well, it certainly should be under the authority of the Jewish people. So it's amazing.
For there to be all the events, is that?
Oh, well, what, you mean for the Messiah to come or something like that? Well, when the Messiah comes, everyone will agree that the best thing is for this to be under the authority of the Jewish people.
But
one of the defining characteristics of the Messiah.
Yeah.
Is that at that point the focus of the world is unified and agreeing. Now, a little foretaste of this that I once experienced was it was at UCL. We had a visiting scholar who had spent a couple of years in our department, a very fine scholar. Of Holocaust studies, actually. He himself was a Holocaust survivor, Professor David Bankia. And he was going back to Israel after having been at UCL for a couple of years. So we met at his home, his and his wife's home, where there was like a little a goodbye gathering. Only it was the time of the World Cup. So since it was the time of the World Cup, the television was on. And most people were not taking very much notice of the television, but then at a certain point, there was a penalty. And that moment of the penalty, even, you know, scholars who had been talking about manuscripts or this or that, you know, or
they got excited.
Yeah. They all turn to look at the television. And they're watching this ball, which is on the ground, and someone is walking backwards in order to take a penalty kick. However, being academic scholars, they retained a little bit of objectivity. And one person says, do you realize about half the world are watching this event? And I thought that was a wonderful foretaste of the Messiah. The moment that half the world, or maybe more. I think later I told this story and people said, no, it's calculated to be more than half the world. So, you know, the way in which if people can be focused on someone kicking a leather ball, you know, it just needs the right context.
But if the Messiah will come, they will switch off.
What?
Many of them will switch off. We'll move to another channel.
So the focus at the time of the Messiah will be that the best thing in the world, the most wonderful thing which we've all been waiting for, and we've all been saying it all along, and no one listened to us, everyone will say, you know, all different groups will say, is that there should be the Jewish temple in Jerusalem. It's, you know, so that will become a point of agreement, because that's the concept of the Messiah. The Messiah comes to completely deconstruct the whole idea of oppositions between different peoples, nations, unity. Now, so there is the Gate of Chulda, where, now the reason it's called that, there was a famous prophetess called Chulda, who used to stand at one or other, or both of these gates, you know, at sometimes this one and sometimes that one, and prophesy. And so these gates were named after her. So it's nice to have a feminine prophetess as, you know, as this mark of the...
Chulda is a kind of
a weasel.
Yes, I mean, what a name to give to a child.
Well, it depends if you like that kind of creature. Kol ma, there is a saying in the Talmud, Kol ma sheyesh bayabasha, yesh bayam. Everything that there is on dry land, there's also in the sea. Chutz min ha-chulda, except for the chulda.
Really?
So there is sea horses, and there is sea this and sea that. You know, everything but the
chulda. Sea weasel.
So, but except for the chulda. So Chulda must have some special quality. And I imagine that Chulda was seen as a nice little creature. It's interesting, you know, the view of cats, for example, here in England, cats are nice little things that people have as pets. In Israel, they're seen as some sort of dangerous creature. It's Jerusalem cats, in my experience, look very...
Maybe the weasel was a pet at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe
the weasel was a pet. Yes, that's what I'm suggesting.
Must have been, yes.
Yeah, it was
it's like a hamster, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, get me a nice chulda. Yeah. I want the chulda in the window. So there was chulda. Now, so then you come into the Ha'abayit. Now, the way I imagine the Ha'abayit in the time of the temple, it's crowded with people who have come from all over Israel. And in fact, since many people lived out of Israel, people lived in Alexandria, people lived in Babylon, people lived in Rome, but they would come in order to be at the temple. So you are meeting people that you haven't met for many years, and so there's this beautiful atmosphere of meeting people there in this, like, milling around in this area of the Ha'abayit, the Temple Mount. There is also, in fact, the normal way you enter is from the east, by the way, through the Shushan Gate. The Shushan Gate, that would be the normal way of going into the temple. And there is a small Sanhedrin, there is a chamber with a Sanhedrin, Sanhedrin Katana.
Shara'ayot will be...
This is where the Israelis got in, the paratroopers.
Shara'ayot would be
My uncle's regiment, who was a Chabadnik. came through Shaar HaAriyot into Jerusalem in 67.
Into Jerusalem, yeah, but this is not the wall around Jerusalem.
Yeah.
This is the wall around the Har HaBayit. Yeah. This, in terms of the wall around Jerusalem, the wall around Jerusalem is a big, right, big wall all the way around.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry.
There is... is it at the Holy Land Hotel or somewhere else? A beautiful model of Jerusalem in temple times, of the whole of Jerusalem, with the wall.
I've seen that somewhere, yeah.
I've seen it, yes. I actually have a picture.
It might be somewhere. No, it might be somewhere else. There's some kind of museum.
In the Jewish quarter?
Open land. Mm. Yes?
No, this is in the Holy Land in a museum somewhere.
Could be. It could be that it's imitated. I saw it in some open air display.
It used to be outside the Holy Land.
Actually, the Holy Land Hotel had, as well as the temple itself, they had the whole of Jerusalem.
Jerusalem.
Jerusalem and temple. Anyway. So then one goes in, now one then goes towards the actual structure of the temple. So let's turn over the page, and we're going into the temple itself. And we're advancing from the east side, and that means we come in and there is the Sanhedrin, another Sanhedrin. There are actually three Sanhedrin, three courts, each one higher
than
in
other.
Terms of justice, higher than the one before. So there's another Sanhedrin, and then we have these four compartments, which are, one is for keeping wood, and one is for keeping oil. They are like storerooms of the temple. But this whole outer courtyard, called the woman's courtyard, is very interesting because they would build a balcony around this courtyard for the women to stand. And that's the basis of the synagogue, the medieval synagogue and later modern synagogue, where you have the men downstairs and the women on the balcony upstairs. This comes from the women's courtyard in the temple. So the women's courtyard as such was mixed. But there were certain times of the year, particularly at Sukkot, when the women would stand, they would build a structure, and the women would stand on top, and down below, the men would be dancing very wildly. This was during the Sukkot festival, and rabbis would be suddenly reveal their skills as jugglers and burning torches, and things of this kind. This was all happening in this woman's courtyard. So the woman's courtyard is a sacred part of the temple, but as one goes further and further into the temple, the level of sanctity becomes greater and greater. So you couldn't have this kind of levity in the inner courtyard. It's in the outer courtyard, the women's courtyard, that you can have this dancing and singing. In fact, during Sukkot, the Talmud relates, there were people who, like from morning to night, there was something to do, watching the priests doing this and watching the high priest doing that. And then dancing all night long in the Simchat Beit HaShoeva, the joy of the water drawing. So it ended up with people never going to bed for days on end and just drowsing while they were like with their arms around each other's shoulders dancing, and so drowsing for a little bit and then going on dancing. So that was the that's the women's courtyard. Now then we have 15 steps. You see the semicircular image, that is actually steps in order to climb slightly higher to get into the inner courtyard. Now those 15 steps correspond to the Book of Psalms, where it's got Shir HaMa'alot. Mm-hmm. How many Shir HaMa'alot are there? The Song of Steps. 15. Mm-hmm. So there are 15 songs of the steps, because also to do with the water drawing, they would sing each of these little Shir HaMa'alot as they were walking up the steps. So step by step, so it was a ceremonial thing. Now on the left and right of the steps was some kind of cupboard. And the Talmud tells us in that cupboard the Levites would keep their musical instruments. Mm. Because the Levites were part of the temple environment playing musical instruments. And so therefore they needed somewhere to keep those instruments, and that's on either side of the steps. Then we go higher. And you see on the right, there is the Great Sanhedrin. Now that was the High Court, the ultimate High Court, with 71 elders who were there, and most of the time, most of them were there. And so part of, I don't know how visible they were, you know, whether you could take a peep, you know, like you could go to the Houses of Parliament and you could like, see the, you know, the legislators of the land. I'm not sure how visible the Great Sanhedrin was, but certainly if you waited around the temple, you know, you would see them coming in and coming out. You know, there's the famous rabbi this and the famous rabbi that. That's, we were very much into the sort of drama of famous people. You know, the Talmud tells us a little anecdote how there was the high priest walking along and a whole crowd of people were following him. You know, like this sort of glamour.
Celebrity.
Yes, celebrity glamour. Very much sort of Jewish.
Nothing changed.
Old Jewish. Well, they blame us for creating Hollywood. So we just produce secular versions of the same thing.
Yeah, but if you look at the Catholic Church today, I mean, ostentatiousness and the gold and the order is
well, it's all copied from our so there's a crowd of people following the high priest, and who of course is a descendant of Aaron and therefore has very great yichus, very great you know, ancestral nobility. But suddenly Shemaiah and Avtalion appeared, who were the two leading rabbis at the time, who did not come from illustrious forebears. And but they were very famous as great rabbis. And the crowd left behind the high priest and began following Shemaiah and Avtalion, and the high priest was suitably indignant.
I remember they let Hillel freeze on the roof.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. So there was this. So whether or not we would catch a glimpse of the Great Sanhedrin, I don't know. Now there is also this. A kind of platform which goes along the length. Now there, I think you would have the Levites there, singing and playing. And, somewhere near there you would also have the Kohanim who would stand and bless the people. So, this was a, and then you're moving, so this is really like more spiritual part of the temple. Then we're moving inwards on the right, where it's got like four little compartments. That was a place where the Kohanim would sleep overnight in the temple. And there would be a fire burning there to keep them warm. And so they would be sleeping there. And on the roof of that section, there was a mikveh where they could purify themselves. And then, so now walking through, then there's the altar with the slope leading up to the altar, because there's a verse in the book of Exodus which says, you shouldn't walk up steps to the altar because of modesty. Male modesty. And so there should just be a slope. And that concept of some kind of awareness of this ideal of modesty. So there's the slope. Now the only thing is, there were lots of paradoxical aspects to the temple. And one of them was, people were very eager to be the first one to offer the offering in the morning. And the original way they used to decide how to offer, who would be the first. Well, I wonder if this was some kind of Greek influence, you know, but what they would do, they would have a race up the slope of the altar. And the one who got to the top first, he would then offer the offering. So now
like conception.
Hmm?
Like conception.
Conception. Which spermatozoon gets there first? Well, it's an interesting image. Now the great sage, the Chofetz Chaim, he lived here. He passed away in the 1930s. He was Rabbi Yisrael Meir of Radin. He was a great sage in the first half of the century. He's famous for his books about Lashon Hara, not speaking the evil tongue. Even more significant in many ways is his halachic compendium called Mishneh Brura, which explains practical halakha in contemporary terms. He was a Kohen. And he fervently believed the Messiah was coming, because all the signs that the Talmud describes of social chaos and political chaos had all been seen during the First World War period, and so he was convinced the Messiah was coming. Now, since he was a Kohen, it would be advantageous to be a fast runner so that you could run up the slope and get to the top quickly. So he used to practice running, I think to the scandal of some of his rabbinic contemporaries who didn't think this was quite the...
he was jogging.
He went jogging every day.
No, sprint.
Well, yeah, that's right. Sprint and jogging are two different sprints. Yes, yeah. This was 100-yard sprint. Yeah.
He holds a few records.
But Chaim was in Jerusalem.
Sorry?
But Chaim.
He was in Jerusalem, wasn't he?
No, he was in Poland.
He never made it to the Holy Land.
He might have visited the Holy Land, yeah. But he was active in Poland. He was the head, leading figure in Agudat Yisrael, so part of Agudat Yisrael. Well, and it's once happened that while they were running up the slope, someone was, he fell, he was pushed, you know, he fell off the slope, which wasn't very good. So eventually they developed other ways of selecting who would be the kind of drawing of lot, you know, who would be the first person. But, you know, when you get into the temple life and the temple atmosphere, it was very...
competitive.
It was competitive, yes.
Like in the Holy Sepulchre these days, when they opened the gates and we were able to go to the Old City, we befriended some priests there, Greek Orthodox priests who were students at the university, so there was some connection. And they were telling us horrible, horrid tales of knifing, of fighting, of sometimes the police had to come, and there were five different denominations there.
They were the Holy Sepulchre, actually.
Yeah.
Fight all the time.
And they were fighting over space and over domination and over whatever.
It still happens until today. I don't think all the time.
Still.
No, they had a fight also a couple of months ago.
Yes.
And apparently the Israelis are coming over to impose peace between them.
Yeah, oh yes. Yeah. So until today.
That's human nature, isn't it?
Well, it's interesting. You know, there's different varieties of competitiveness. At the same time, I think, you know, the general atmosphere that comes over of the relationships between the Kohanim was of a kind of a brotherhood. But at the same time, within that, they were competitive. Also, incidentally, each group of Kohanim is only there for a week at a time.
And
then they changed. And the way it worked out, there were 24 groups of Kohanim. So approximately twice a year, for a week, each Kohen would be there.
You have, oh, I see, right.
But it was a week, a very intense week.
And how many of them were there at every shift? Does one know?
Well, in order to bring an offering, you needed somebody. The Mishnah in Tamid, it describes how many Kohanim are needed to bring one offering, you know, sometimes 15, 18. So that's one offering, then there's other offering. So, like, it, probably several hundred at any one time are in the temple.
Gosh.
You know, something like that. I'm not sure the actual figure. They would come from all over Israel, where they lived. The Kohanim lived in different parts of Israel. There was no territory which was allocated specifically to the Kohanim. So the Kohanim lived all over, and they would have tithes. The truma, which a farmer, he reaped his field, so he would give a certain proportion of that field to the Kohanim and to the Levites. The Levites, the same thing. The Levites also were divided in groups and came also for a week at a time. So it was a group of Kohanim and a group of Levites from all over Israel coming together. And that was a or for various parts of Israel. And each one had his turn. Then you have these hooks. They and tables, which are next to the altar. They represent the actual process of slaughtering and cleaning the animals which are going to be offered on the altar.
I wasn't quite aware of the actual preparation in the temple.
Well, in the temple, yes, they slaughtered the animal in the temple precinct in this area. Some of its blood would be caught in a special chalice, and then that would be sprinkled on the edges.
I knew about the chalice and everything. I just wasn't quite aware.
Yeah, it's all happening here. In fact, because of that, the floor of the temple, the marble floor of the temple, would get very dirty. And there was a river or stream, it doesn't show it in this diagram, which flowed through the temple. And they would somehow dam the exits, and so the water would rise up and it would cover the whole ground of the temple. And then they would open it, and then it would pour out, and thus effectively it would wash the temple floor. Of course, this is Hadrian's temple, using Roman, you know, plumbing technology, like Roman baths, you know, so it was a more technologically sophisticated structure. I don't think they had that.
That would be the second temple.
Yeah, in the second temple, yes.
What's the first one? Exactly the same.
The first one did not have this women's courtyard, for example.
Oh, I see, right.
You see, the first one was just this area, which is much more like the sanctuary described in the Book of Exodus.
Right.
However, the temple described in the Book of Ezekiel is much more complicated. And the second temple is a kind of mixture of the first temple, which is really described in the Book of Kings, and it's just a larger version of what's described in the Book of Exodus, trying to put together ideas from the Book of Ezekiel, so the which is the we see as the ultimate temple, and had like complicated architectural things, like very highly ornamented gateways and things like that, which they couldn't follow. They weren't able to imitate. But so in the Book of Ezekiel, there's another description of the temple, which is very interesting. Then on the left over here, there's a laver where the Kohanim would wash their hands and feet every day. They had to walk barefoot on the marble floor, because if they wore a foot covering, it would be as if they are putting something between themselves and this sacred ground. It's like if you're shaking a lulav, you can't wear gloves. It has to be the actual hand of the person touching the lulav. So the same way here, there had to be a direct sense of contact.
No chatzitza.
Is this is this a copy of what we see in front of temples where the men wash their feet and hands today? The Islamic, the mosques.
Well, obviously, Islamic imagery would derive from Jewish imagery.
No, I just wanted to see the picture. Because I know what they look like, so I wanted to see them.
Well, to Islam, our temple was very important. Yeah. And, the image of the temple and various things about it. In fact, the maqam, the Islamic musical scale, is said in Islamic sources to be based on the music of the temple, of the Jewish temple. It's... there are Jewish elements in the Islamic tradition, which they call the Israelita. They call it the Jewish section. And now some Jewish academics, some scholars of Judaism, are turning to this Islamic material in order to find out things about early Judaism in the 5th, 6th century and get some ideas from what was regarded in Islamic sources to be Jewish. So that might tell us something about what was Jewish. So there is the laver, and in the way in which this is symbolized today is that the Kohanim in a synagogue, before they bless the community, their hands are washed by the Levites. So we don't wash their feet, but we do wash their hands. And so that is part of the structure of a modern synagogue. So every modern synagogue is supposed to have a place for washing, sometimes more elaborate than others, but somehow or other the Kohanim need to be washed. And then you have these steps in front of the holy section. And now, if we can, there's a rather complicated hallway in front of this more holy section. This is now a roofed section, and these like boxes. These are actual chambers of some kind. And in fact, it wasn't only one floor, it was several floors high. It was quite a high building. As I showed you in that picture, you could see the tall structure, which typifies the temple. And then we go into what is called the Kodesh, or the Heichal. And there, you can see straight ahead is the golden altar where incense was offered. That's in the middle. There's a line, there's a wording which mentions that. On the right of that, further in, is the golden table on which the Lechem HaPanim was put, the showbread. That showbread was there, 12 loaves of bread, which was changed every week on Shabbat with the new fresh set of loaves of bread, and the old loaves of bread were divided up among the Kohanim. And there again was a bit of a scramble, getting pieces of the Lechem HaPanim.
You say there was hundreds of them.
Well, it says, Hatznuim mashchu yadehem. The more modest ones stood back. They weren't going to be part of the fray. And one Kohen, he once said, לא הגיע לי אלא כזנב הלטאה, something like that. I only got a lizard's tail amount of lechem apanim, of the showbread. And people were rather shocked at this comparison. And they then found out he wasn't really a Kohen at all.
He wasn't an intruder.
He wasn't an intruder. Yeah, well, the Talmud tells stories about people who tried to be intruders. There was a man who wasn't Jewish, who would go to Jerusalem and pretend to be a Jew and eat from the Paschal lamb. And he boasted about this to Rabbi Yeshua Haglili. He boasted about this to a rabbi who was in the north of Israel. So the rabbi said to him, "Ah, but did they give you the fat tail of the lamb?" If they, no, no. Oh, if they didn't give you the fat tail of the lamb, means they're cheating you. You're not getting the real. So the next time he went, he said, "What about the fat tail?" So no, there's no such thing as the fat tail of the lamb. So him talking about the fat tail made people suspicious. And they found out that he wasn't. So this idea of a kind of a select, you see, even though a non-Jew can come to the temple and offer an offering, and this is something that King Solomon describes in the Book of Kings, when he's completed the temple, and he's speaking to God at the dedication of the temple, and he says, if the non-Jew comes and he prays to you, he's like telling God what to do. Typical Jewish mode. If the non-Jew comes and he prays to you, grant his request. And if the Jew comes and prays to you, if he is worthy, grant his request. So the sages comment that the bar is lower for the non-Jew, you know. That you want to encourage people to come and to see the temple as a place of spiritual connection. So let their request be granted, whether they're worthy or not. The Jew, on the other hand, has to be a little bit more careful. So that's the... So there is the golden table. And then on the left, there is the menorah, which is also made of gold. So this is in this enclosed area. And you can imagine the fragrance of the incense from the golden altar. Every day, twice, in the morning and in the evening, incense was offered on the golden altar. And it was a special privilege for the Kohanim to offer incense. And it was believed to be a skula for wealth. So, therefore, the person who offered the incense would always be chosen as someone who never had that opportunity before. So they would always take a new person to offer the incense, so that everyone would have that chance. Now, the incense itself was very special. The incense had 11 ingredients, one of which did not have a good smell. And this is regarded as representing like the Jewish people, where you have different kinds of people, and also those who are really not so good are also part of the Jewish people. They all also have to be included. So, and then we have the menorah on the left. So this area here is lit up by the faint lights of the menorah. That's the shining lights of the menorah. And then you see a curtain, it's a double curtain, and you can enter from the left and walk through this sort of dark little corridor, and then you emerge at the other side. Now, the only person who would ever walk through this would be the high priest. That's right. On when?
Yom Kippur.
On Yom Kippur.
That's and in the how would be the Ark of the Covenant?
Sorry?
What would be in the Har itself? The Ark?
Now, we're coming there. So having got into the Kodesh HaKodeshim, what is there? In the time of the first temple, it was the Ark. But the Ark was lost during the period of exile between the first and second temple. So now there is no Ark there in the time of the second temple. Instead, there is a flat stone, which is called the Eben Shtiyah, the stone from which the world is founded. And that's described by the sages as a flat stone, not as a mammoth object, which is in the Dome of the Rock. So that is the Eben Shtiyah, and the high priest would go there and would, and on Yom Kippur, with a pan of incense, and he would sprinkle blood towards the Eben Shtiyah.
He would sprinkle?
blood, the blood of an offering.
Okay, yes.
Yes, right, so that's part of the whole process. So there is some kind of vital energy, which this interaction, you know, this concept of blood.
You know, when we talk about purity and being clean and unclean, and, you know, the presence of death and life, how we started, and yet, yeah, we throw in blood, most holy.
Yeah, killing animals and
yet it's all in the temple.
And this is in the Holy of Holies.
And this is in the Holy of Holies. So I'm sorry.
It's as if that we're at this, some kind of inner organs of existence. And it's true there is blood moving.
Double temple, as you said, the floor. Rose.
Yes, they would have to wash it clean. It's true that there is a sense in which we are in the inner organs of existence, and so therefore it's not like a drawing room. It's a different atmosphere, and at the same time there's the concept of purity and impurity in order. It's a little bit like a surgeon who has to wash his hands with the most meticulous care and wear rubber gloves, which are only worn that one time. And then what does he do? that's right. Yeah.
It would have been interesting to know the symbolism of all that. Why the blood, and why?
Well, we're talking here about a certain kind of interchange of life force. I mean, it's really bringing together different aspects of existence and connecting with the divine. And the essence of the divine is there in the Holy of Holies. And the altar is a point where the spiritual quality of the temple, which is really expressed as the fire on the altar. The fire on the altar is this divine spirituality, meets with the human being who is bringing the offering, the animal offering, the libations of wine and olive oil which accompany the offering, and flour, wheat flour, and salt, which is like the mineral.
So there's all the elements that of creation.
That's right. The regions of creation, animal, human, animal, vegetable, mineral, meeting together on the altar with the divine fire. So it's this point of contact between existence and the infinite, which is happening there on the altar. All right. Now, if we turn briefly to the pages of Tanya that we have over here. So here, chapter 52, he's trying to explain what is special about the temple. In chapter 51, which we haven't got printed here, he asks the question, why should the temple be different to anywhere else in the world? Surely God is everywhere. So what's so special about the temple? If you believe in God, so God is this infinite force, and that infinite force is totally unlimited and is everywhere. Omnipresent, omnipotent. So what's special about the temple? What have you just remembered?
I forgot to ask Michael to go to the wall. Hold on, I'm just going to ask him to do that now. I'm so sorry.
No, it's all right.
No, sorry. Excuse me, please go on.
So there is the question, what is the nature of the temple? And you can see the image here in chapter 52, if you just look in English. Now, just as in the human soul, the principal manifestation of the general vitality is in the brain. Kumo shebenishmat ha'adam ikar gilu klalut ha'chayut hu b'mochin. וכל האיברים מקבלים אור בכוח לבד, המה להם ממקור גילו החיות שבמוחים. So in other words, you've got the brain, And then there are all the limbs of the body, and the limbs of the body receive energy from the brain. Now this image is being used to explain what is the temple. The temple is the brain of existence. The whole of existence fits together, and the temple is the makor hachayut, the source of life force, the source of energy, and that's like the brain at every level. Now, so therefore, the brain, when we speak about the source of life force, we're really speaking about the Shekhinah, the divine presence, which gives life to everything. So that's exactly what is there in the Holy of Holies. Now,
is it because we were given? Isn't it? I've heard it's because it's a dwelling place for God, and He gave precise instructions how to build it. We followed the recipe in the way that we haven't followed the recipe if we build another building. So it's the closest we can get on earth to a spot which is holy by halakhic means.
Well, that's a good way of describing it, that we're following God's exact instructions in building this place, and therefore that's a way in which it's expressing the sanctity of God. But Kabbalistic teachings will take it a stage further and will say, first of all, given that God is manifest, how can God be veiled? How can this power of the presence of God be veiled in a suitable way that it can dwell in the world? Lo yirani ha'adam v'chai, man cannot see me and live. Surely the intensity of godliness is so powerful it will dissolve away the world. And so the cloak, this is what it's got on the page 273 to 274. What is this garment? Do you see that paragraph? But what is this garment? You see, a garment which is able to conceal and clothe the Shekhinah, yet will not itself be completely nullified within its light. The garment is God's blessed will and wisdom, which are clothed in the Torah and its commandments. So in other words, the Torah, the teachings of the Torah, and the divine will, which is expressed in the Torah, is the garment which is able, so to speak, to contain the infinite radiance of the divine presence. Now, while you were out...
Sorry, say that again.
Okay. Okay, well, let's go back to the beginning. The image is used in order to try to understand what is the temple. Within a human being, the source of life force and energy of the whole body is the brain. We don't see the brain, but the brain is the force which is giving energy to everything else that we do. God forbid there's something seriously wrong with the brain, then everything else is paralyzed, unable to operate. So the brain is the source of life force. Now, the image that Rabbi Shneur Zalman uses to explain the nature of the temple is that the temple is like the brain of existence, at this plane of existence. And there are different levels of existence. And at each level, there is a temple. So you see, if you're speaking of the Sfirot, of the sacred Sfirot, that's a higher level of existence, the Chochmah, Binah, and Da'at level of those Sfirot, wisdom, understanding, and knowledge, the higher level of the Sfirot, that's like the holy part, that's the source of life force on that plane. And when we come down to our physical world, it's the physical temple and the structure of the temple, which is like the brain of existence. So the energy of the divine presence, which is there in the temple, that's what's giving life to everything, and that's what is radiating in the temple. But how is this energy able to be contained? That's where we've got up to. How can the energy of the divine be able to be contained? It's too intense. And the answer that comes is that the only thing that can contain the divine energy is the will and wisdom of God, which is itself the Torah. The Torah which expresses God's will and God's wisdom, the Torah is something which is godly and emerges from God, and yet in some way is a cloak of God. It's a kind of a garment of God. Or Te'or Kasalma, God puts on radiance like a robe. And that's the robe of Torah. And so therefore Torah itself is the cloak which encloses God and protects us from God and enables us to relate to God.
Symbolically,
well, it's interesting, you know, at what point the symbol is the reality. Because the Torah is in the Holy of Holies. In the Holy of Holies, originally, there is the Ark, the Golden Ark. And in the Golden Ark are the two sapphire tablets of stone, which Moses brought down Mount Sinai. In fact, there are also the broken tablets, which he brought down the first time, and the Torah scroll. So it's quite a collection of literary artifacts there in this Holy of Holies. And that is the source of Torah. Ki Mitzion Tetzei Torah. So I'm not sure at what point is the symbol and what point the reality. Because the question is, what is existence? And how are we able to cognate existence? Can we conceive of existence? And the fact of there being the Torah enables us to relate to the divine, which is empowering this entire existence. So there's this image in the book of Leviticus that between the two cherubs on the golden ark with their outstretched wings, there would come a voice speaking to Moshe and dictating to him the Torah. So this sort of form of this energy transfer which is taking place. And so that is the temple on this
microphone.
That's right. Yes. And so then the next few pages sort of carry this through, the way in which at every level the divine presence is there. At the level of the Holy of Holies in that world, whichever world we are in. And on page 275, near the end of the page, in a like manner the Shekhinah descended and clothed itself in the shrine of the Holy of Holies of Asiyah, of the world of action. And it continues in this vein, describing the way if we go on to page 277, it is from the Shekhinah. Would you like to read this, Millie? It is from the Shekhinah, page 277. Look at the pagination at the bottom. That paragraph, it is from the Shekhinah.
I have the wrong glasses. It is from the Shekhinah, which is closed in the shrine of the Holy of Holies of each and every general or particular world, that light and vitality, this is really bad, are extended and diffused to the whole world and the creatures contained therein, the souls, angels, and so forth, for all of them were created by the 10
fiats.
Fiats, what's that?
It's like a Sarah Mamarim, Mamarot.
In the act of creation, these beings, the word of God, which is termed Shekhinah.
Right, so
fiat is there shall be.
Yes, that's right. So you can see it much more clearly in the Hebrew. Vihinei mahashchinah, would you like to read those same words in the Hebrew? Vihinei mahashchinah.
Vihinei mahashchinah melubeshet b'echal kodesh hakodashim shel kol olam ve'olam. כללי או פרטי, נמשך או מתפשט ממנה אור וחיות לכל העולם והברואים שבו נשמות ומלאכים וכו'. כי כולם נבראו בעשרה מאמרות שבמעשה בראשית שהם דבר השם הנקרא בשם שכינה.
Right. That's beautiful.
Absolutely beautiful. In Hebrew it makes sense to me now. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's easier to learn Hebrew than to read the English translation. but indeed that is the nature of the temple. So there is this tremendous focus of spiritual energy. Now, just to conclude what this article talks about, this article goes back to the beginning of creation that we have discussed together about the way in which the divine was originally in the Garden of Eden together with Adam and Eve. And due to the sin of eating from the tree of knowledge and so on, and Cain killing Abel, so you have the hiding, the concealment of this divine presence, which then has to be drawn back to the world. And eventually, there's the building, page 8, there's the building of the physical sanctuary in which the divine is going to dwell. And so therefore, this is a kind of recreation of the Garden of Eden. And what is the Garden of Eden? Because when the divine dwells within the sanctuary, it is also dwelling within each person's heart as well. They should make for me a sanctuary and I will dwell within them, within each individual. And so there you have, on page 9, it talks about sanctuary is community. On page 10, sanctuary is family. That in other words, the resolution of the temple in the lives of human beings is in their own heart and in their relationship to other human beings and within the context of their own family, and the way in which the Shabbat, the Jewish Shabbat, is the way in which suddenly our whole home becomes radiant like the sanctuary, and there is the spiritual energy together. And the core, as it goes on to say on page 11, love and holiness. And that love of one's fellow, is the expression of holiness, leading ultimately, on page 12, the whole world as a sacred garden, that from the sanctuary, and when the sanctuary, when the temple is rebuilt, the whole world will be a sacred and a holy world, where there will only be peace and goodness.
Yishkoach. Well, we presume that the Ark of the Covenant was in the Echad during the first temple.
Yeah. And then it was hidden. So
it was a very interesting documentary of, I don't remember who'd done it, and I was very suspicious and I wasn't sure I wanted to see it, but I did sit through it.
It's in Africa?
Yes. That it went through and he actually traced it. And then he got all the way down to South Africa.
Or Zimbabwe.
The border of Zimbabwe and South Africa. Have you seen it?
No.
Have you heard about it?
I've heard about
it. It's connected to the theory that the son of Queen Sheba and King Solomon stole it.
Right.
And took it with him overnight to Africa.
It's wonderful how Judaism generates so many.
No, this particular now.
Not this particular.
Still have the root in
Ethiopia.
No.
Exum.
No. But this is not. This is a different story.
It's a different theory. Yeah, you're right.
This was that during the destruction, it was actually smuggled out, taken out, and they kept going up.
Sorry.
Oh, Nigel. Yes. Thank you for coming.
Shall we just organize another date?
Yes. Stay a minute.
Just say a second.
It was more scientific, wasn't it?